And thanks to everybody who has made a contribution in our spring membership drive. We are very grateful. Good afternoon and welcome to Midday. As I said, I'm Tom Hall here in Studio A. I want to begin with a special programming note. WYPR is collaborating with WJZ-TV and our news partner, the Baltimore Banner, on Tuesday, April 30th for a debate between the four leading candidates in the Democratic primary for mayor. The debate will be broadcast live on WYPR during midday and again on WJZ-TV at 7 o'clock that night. Denise Koch, Emily Sullivan, and I will moderate that debate. Again, that's a week from next Tuesday, April 30th, and the day before that program, on Monday, April 29th, we'll host the Democratic candidates for Baltimore City Council President here on Midday. I'll moderate that forum with Nick Mosby, Zeke Cohen, and Shannon Sneed. So next week, we will continue our series of conversations with the candidates with Delegate Joe Vogel. He's one of the candidates in the Democratic primary for the House of Representatives in the 6th District. And you can check out all of my conversations with the candidates on the WYPR website, including the candidates that we're featuring in web-only interviews for various offices. By the time early voting begins on May 2nd, we will have posted 27 interviews with candidates for Baltimore Mayor, Baltimore City Council President, the House of Representatives, and the U.S. Senate. Today on Midday, it's the Midday News Wrap. We'll take a look behind the headlines of some of the big national and local stories of the week. A jury has been seated in Donald Trump's trial in New York. He has pled not guilty to 34 felony counts of falsifying business records. Israel has responded to Iran's attack over the weekend with strikes at an airbase near the central Iranian city of Isfahan and at an air defense unit in southern Syria. Reuters reports that a senior Iranian official said there are no plans to respond to Israel, leading diplomats to believe that an escalation of the conflict between Iran and Israel has been averted, at least for the moment. And Capitol Hill has had no shortage of drama this week. We turn first today in the news wrap to Luke Broadwater, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter who covers Congress for the New York Times. Luke, welcome back. Always great to talk to you.
Hey, good afternoon, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about the bills that Speaker Mike Johnson looks like he's going to get a vote on tomorrow in a special session. Congress was supposed to leave town, but they're going to stick around at least for a little while to talk about foreign aid. Tell us what the lawmakers will be voting on tomorrow.
Sure. Well, this is a national security package that has been pushed by the White House. It provides almost $100 billion between Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan, and then Speaker Johnson added on a few other sort of Republican or conservative priorities, including a bill forcing the sale of TikTok. These will all get separate votes, but will eventually come over as a united package. It's something that the White House wants very badly. It's something that Democrats in the Senate want very badly. The resistance here has been the right wing of the Republican Party in the House, which does not want to fund Ukraine, does not want money going to help Ukraine fight off Vladimir Putin's invasion. And so Speaker Johnson has had to wrestle with this right wing, and he's actually had a huge change of heart on this issue. When he was a rank and file member, he had voted against sending aid to Ukraine. And but since he's become Speaker, he's changed his point of view on that. He's had briefings from the intelligence community, from national security officials. He's met with the heads of influential committees like Armed Services and Foreign Affairs, and they've stressed to him how badly this money and these weapons are needed to help Ukraine and what it means for the rest of the world and for Europe. And so he's changed his point of view. And because of that, he's facing a lot of backlash from the right. But he looks poised now to pass these bills through the House and get them over to the Senate and on to President Biden's desk, where he will sign them.
And Marjorie Taylor Greene, Thomas Massey, a couple of Republicans who are saying that they are inclined to trigger what's called a motion to vacate. Is the fact that Speaker Johnson is bringing these bills to the floor, and that if they pass, it looks like they're going to pass only with Democratic support. Is that enough to animate a motion to vacate? In other words, have Speaker Johnson removed from the speakership?
Well, Marjorie Taylor Greene has filed this motion. She has not called the vote, though, yet. She's been using it as leverage to try to get Johnson, Speaker Johnson, to do what she wants. But he's not listening to her. And so he is rolling the dice here and saying it's too important to aid Ukraine. It's too important to stop Vladimir Putin. So I'm going to do this whether or not it costs me my job. Now, what's been said is that if Marjorie Taylor Greene does indeed force this vote to kick Speaker Johnson out, Democrats, I've talked to quite a few of them. I talked to Abigail Spanberger about this. I know of a few others who will introduce a motion to table that. And so Democrats plan to save Speaker Johnson should he follow through with the Ukraine bill. So they're poised to block the hard right on this issue. What that will mean politically for Speaker Johnson is he'll be in a very tenuous position where he will be serving as the speaker at the pleasure of the other party. And we all know that in today's political environment, especially in the Republican Party, if you are seen as an ally of Democrats, you're the enemy. And so I would only expect that after this happens for the anger and the vitriol directed at Speaker Johnson to increase.
I understand Marjorie Taylor Greene actually proposed an amendment that said if anybody voted for aid to Ukraine, they would be required to enlist in the Ukrainian army. So, you know, we're talking about just, you know, completely silly and frivolous, you know, behavior on the part of Congresswoman Greene. What's different about Mike Johnson than Kevin McCarthy, which is to say, why is it that Democrats seem to be willing to save Speaker Johnson when they weren't willing to save Kevin McCarthy? I guess this is this comes down to the Democrats wanting to send aid to Ukraine and Israel, for that matter.
Yes, I actually had a long conversation with a very senior Democratic leader the other day about this very topic, and what he said was they were very skeptical of Mike Johnson when he became Speaker. They viewed him as a, sort of a far right lawmaker, but since he has become Speaker, in their view, he has essentially been a man of his word. That if he says he's going to do something, you know, the knock on Johnson is that he's slow, he doesn't like to make decisions, he's too green, he's a rookie, he doesn't really know things, and so he takes forever to figure something out and arrive at a position, and he ends up punting and delaying a lot of decisions. But they said he hasn't lied to the Democrats. And their view of Kevin McCarthy was that he was untrustworthy, and that he lied repeatedly to them. And he had alienated the Democrats every bit as much as he had alienated the hard right. And so when it came time for the hard right to kick out Speaker McCarthy, he looked around for who might save him, and there were no Democrats willing to do it. Johnson has not alienated the Democrats in the same way. Yes, they may not like that he's so conservative. They may not like many of his positions, but they don't view him as deceitful in their dealings with him. And so I think that is the main difference for why they would be willing to save Mike Johnson and why they were all too happy to kick Kevin McCarthy out of the speakership.
Luke Broadwater covers Congress for the New York Times. It's the Midday News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall. So, Luke, there are four bills that Congress is probably going to vote on tomorrow. The House is going to vote on tomorrow. It looks like it's headed that way. One's for Israel, one's for Ukraine, one's for Taiwan. And then there's a fourth one that's kind of a grab bag of a lot of different national security things. It includes a ban on TikTok. And that's been pretty controversial. And there's some differences between the House and the Senate on that. Can you tell us what's in that fourth package that will probably come to a vote tomorrow?
Sure. It's a number of things that Johnson viewed as sweeteners for the right wing of his conference. Some of the things have been endorsed by Donald Trump, even. One of them would make the Ukraine aid, you know, essentially a loan where Ukraine would eventually have to pay it back. Another one would use the assets of Russian oligarchs that have been seized to pay for the money that would go to Ukraine. A lot of the conservatives in the House want to see, they don't like deficit spending, so they want the money to come from somewhere. So that gives them something that they would like. And then there's this matter with the TikTok ban. What the TikTok bill would do is it would force the sale of TikTok to an American company. The right wing is very skeptical of TikTok, but also a lot of Democrats are too. They believe that the Chinese government uses it and uses the data from it to essentially monitor Americans, potentially influence American elections or American views on issues. They say that they will feed more divisive content on TikTok to Americans than they will inside of China. And so they don't want TikTok in the hands of Chinese companies anymore. And so essentially what this will mean is either it will have to be sold or it won't be allowed in America anymore. It will simply, you could use it in other countries, but not here. That has caused backlash from some on the right and the left in both parties who don't like that level of government intrusion into a private business. But it does seem like it's more popular than not and would pass both chambers and go to the president's desk. And so that's one reason why Johnson included it, because he thinks it can help him get the votes for the rest of the package.
You also wrote about reauthorization of the FISA Act, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, that started back in 1978. That has created some interesting and strange bedfellows, including hard-right Republicans and Democratic progressives. Chuck Schumer has mentioned a deadline of today to get that business taken care of. Where does that stand?
Yeah, I doubt they'll get a deal today. I would expect that to also go into the weekend, which would mean that FISA 702 would lapse. And there are differing views on how worrisome that is. FISA 702 has been extended by a court for another year, but it would be in a legal limbo where, if somebody did challenge complying with it, it would be up to the courts to say whether or not it was still legal. A court has extended it, but if lawmakers don't, you could see how that could be an argument that could maybe go either way in the courts. At issue here is, of course, 702 of FISA allows the federal government to collect without a warrant communications of people overseas. Generally, they're people that our government believes are involved in some way with terrorism. It's about 250,000 people. But in doing that, sometimes those people communicate with Americans. And so some American emails or texts or calls are picked up in this data. And so the current debate in Congress is when the FBI or other federal agencies want to search that data for an American's communications, do they have to get a warrant? Right now, they don't. It's already in their possession. They're allowed to just search through it because it didn't come from the Americans. But some in Congress want to add a warrant requirement. And that was actually a tie vote in the House last week, 212 to 212 over this. It's one of the craziest things I've seen. And Speaker Johnson essentially broke the tie himself to not have the warrant requirement in there. The White House doesn't want the warrant. Chuck Schumer doesn't want the warrant. And some Democrats are trying to put that warrant requirement in right now in the Senate. And Schumer is blocking them currently from having a vote on it. We'll see if that gets resolved or not. But as of right now, it looks like there will be a lapse tonight of FISA, and maybe it will get renewed probably like Sunday or Monday is what I would guess.
Well, we indeed will stay on top of it and keeping an eye on it, and you will keep a very eagle eye on it, as you always do. Luke Broadwater covers Congress for the New York Times. Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. Looks like you're in for a long weekend, so get some sleep tonight and enjoy it.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Tom. And I was just thinking, we have a rematch of Trump and Biden, but we also have a rematch of Brandon Scott and Sheila Dixon. It's like 2020 all over again.
That's it. It's Groundhog Day here in Baltimore and beyond. So, certainly a lot about Baltimore. You won a Pulitzer Prize for reporting on Baltimore at the Sun before your tenure at the New York Times began. All right. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up Monday on our show, it's Midday on the Environment. Monday is Earth Day, and we'll speak with Eamon Azar, a reporter with Inside Climate News, and Delegate Laura Kartargudian. We'll talk about the future of offshore wind energy in Maryland with them. And we'll also talk with Ruth Ann Norton and Ann Haveman about changing the way Marylanders warm their homes. So that's on the way Monday. And if you've just joined us today, it's the Midday News Wrap. My next guests are my colleagues from the WIPR news team. Scott Massioni is WIPR's health reporter. Good to see you, sir.
Great to be here.
And Emily Hofstetter is a general assignment reporter who covers literally the waterfront and all things Baltimore. How you doing, Em?
Hey, happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you. They have been covering the progress of reclamation and recovery at the site of the Key Bridge collapse, as well as other stories. And Emily, you did a really nice story about the salvage efforts at the Patapsco River at the site of the Key Bridge collapse. Here's a little bit of what you reported just a day ago.
This is our processing yard where all the materials that are removed from the river are brought by barge and crane to this site, very large pieces of material, steel trusses, some 70 feet by 40 feet.
James Harkness is the chief engineer with the Maryland Transportation Authority.
We've been working on pulling up pieces of the bridge deck, and so that they're using a claw system to be able to lift up the rebar and bring it out of the water.
Workers in man buckets attached to giant floating cranes will hook those claws to the bridge. And the bridge deck is just another word for the road that drivers used to cross. A few hundred yards behind Harkness is a 450-ton piece of steel truss from the Key Bridge, the largest piece removed from the water so far.
When they brought it in yesterday, they actually had to cut it in half because it was about 90 feet tall. So in order to make it manageable for the crews working in the processing yard, they cut it down into half. So the two pieces you see were brought in as one large piece and cut down.
That's a multi-part process. A welder uses an oxyacetylene torch to cut off pieces from the base of the truss. The flame melts down the metal and is then instantly cooled by oxygen, creating a perfect slice in the steel frame. That piece, now freed from the rest of the truss, is grabbed by a set of pinchers, like giant metal claws, and cut down even further.
Like kitchen shears?
Yeah.
That kind of concept, right?
To snap those pieces and make them easier to move.
Sharon Russell claps her hands for emphasis. The small pieces are then taken to local businesses for recycling. There are many locals who hope that steel can be remelted to build a new Key Bridge someday. Russell oversees safety operations for the Unified Command. That's the group of multiple state, local, and federal agencies working together to remove the wreckage from the Key Bridge.
We have over 300 responders working on this, and we've had no injuries to date. We intend to keep it that way. Our priority from Unified Command is the safety of the public and the responders.
Underwater divers have one of the most dangerous jobs. Robin Bianchi leads one of the salvage dive teams.
Visibility, there's no real visibility down there. I mean, we did get lucky a few days and we had 3 to 4 feet, but it's all tide dependent. If we have an incoming tide or an outgoing tide, it can stir a lot of that mud up.
The divers need to make sure that the crane is lifting what it's actually supposed to. Each crane is weighted for a different amount, so pulling up a section that is too big or heavy could be disastrous. And everyone working on site knows it is an underwater graveyard. The bodies of two men are still encased in that wreckage.
And Emily, you know, the search continues for those two men. Four have been recovered. The two remained, just unfindable at the moment. It's the divers have a particularly difficult time, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, like Bianchi said, when they're lucky, they get 3 to 4 feet. It's been an average of like 1 foot of visibility or less. So there are different kinds of specialized dive teams, I learned. You know, there's the Maryland State Police. They do the body recoveries. And then you've got these salvage divers that they're going in there with the limited visibility they have to make sure that they're telling the cranes to attach to the right thing. And it's a combination of sonar analytics, what the divers can see, a little bit of luck. Extremely difficult process. They're on a, like, they called it an umbilical. So it's an air tank, you know, and a cord that goes all the way to land. And so they've also got to navigate that doesn't get wrapped in all of the rebar and the wreckage and the concrete that's down there. I mean, really fabulously dangerous operation.
Yeah, it's super dangerous to be down there because, you know, you're a diver, you've got all these tubes and stuff connected to you that literally keep you alive. They could get cut, too, by pieces of errant steel that are floating around.
Yeah, you know, and I talked to one diver, and he said something, you know, I was just, you know, astounded by their bravery. And he said, yeah, it is scary, but you know what, when we're in a fire, we can't see anything either, because a lot of those, some of those divers, they're firefighters and divers, and I don't know. It just really put into perspective the bravery of these guys and women.
What a way to make a living. So Carlos Daniel Hernandez was recovered. His body was recovered Monday night. He is related to another of the workers who was killed, Alejandro Hernandez Fuentes. He died. He's also related to the worker who survived it somehow, Julio Adrian Cervantes Suarez, and the bodies of Minor Suazo Sandoval and Dorlian Castillo Cabrera are still to be found, but so it's still a sacred place as well as a dangerous place.
Absolutely, and everyone on that site is so aware and respectful of that.
Yeah, and Scott Massioni, the lawyers have gotten involved too. Tell us about the legal developments this week in the bridge.
Well, I mean, we were talking about how much there is to clean up when it comes to the actual site itself. I mean, this is going to be an extremely long phase. We know right now that the families are already suing the shipping company at this point, but the city has now also retained counsel, some of the best trial lawyers that there are in the business, one of them based out of Philadelphia. And this is going to take probably years to sort through, but they're trying to at least show liability and get some money for the city in terms of paying for the issues with people losing jobs, all the traffic issues, really anything you can think of. This could go on for really 2-3 years, even longer than that. And some of the lawyers I talked to said that the discovery phase for this could have documents that are in the millions of pages, if not hundreds of thousands of pages. So this is going to be a huge undertaking for the city and for many lawyers as they sort through this as well.
And one of the lawyers for the families of one of the workers who was killed, Mr. Suarez, said that the workers were not warned about the event as it happened when the ship was approaching the bridge. So that's the first time that that claim has been made. So that certainly will affect the liability issues. But you've got the shipping company saying we want to limit our liability. You've got government officials involved. You've got private individuals involved. This is going to be a legal, just a quagmire that's going to go on forever. And Emily, there are some boats getting through, and I'm calling them boats, but I mean, they're actually ships. I mean, it's not just little boats that are getting through now. The Army Corps of Engineers was incredibly successful getting, you know, some smaller temporary channels open right after the collapse. But now some of the bigger ones are getting through. And what's the timeline to get back to where actually, you know, ships the size of the Dali can actually go through?
Yeah, so the timeline to be open to pretty much normal vessel traffic is the end of May. And officials feel confident right now that they're going to hit that. And hopefully by the end of April, we'll be seeing another channel that would be a 35-foot deep channel. So not container ship size, but you know, 35-foot, you know, allows for some pretty significantly sized vessels.
Yeah, and some of the bridge, evidently, when it fell down and the asphalt, the roadway fell down, it actually embedded the steel in the mud at the bottom of the Patapsco River. And it's way down there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's one of those things that the divers are looking at is, you know, because these cranes, they're weighted for a certain amount of bridge. And so if they accidentally pick up more bridge because it's buried in the mud and try to lift that, that could be a really big problem.
It could break the crane.
It could break the crane. It could be a safety problem. It's not going to be good.
Yeah, the governor did make note of the fact that so far, and it's been, you know, just a couple of weeks since this disaster, that so far none of the workers have been injured doing this incredibly difficult work. When do you have any idea of the number of tons that they've extracted so far?
I believe the most recent number of tons is over 1,100. That might not be the true most recent. That was the last that I heard.
And they, when they get it up and they get it out of the water, I mean, they sort of float it down to Trade Point Atlantic, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you talked
over
a little bit about this. It's a mile.
Over a mile.
So that's a long way to go.
Yeah.
And then it gets there and they're cutting it up and moving it around. So the Trade Point Atlantic's a pretty busy place right now.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's just piles of steel on the piers there. They take the torch, cut it, and then they snap it even further with these big pinchers, and then that goes out to get recycled. You know, maybe some of that can be part of a new key bridge.
Yeah, and they're using sonar to actually see what's embedded in the mud, too.
Yeah.
You have incredible pictures on the WYPR website of showing this steel structure just plunged into the mud. It's crazy.
Yeah.
And very difficult. Now, the other thing, I remember when I interviewed Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg a couple of weeks ago, he made an interesting point, which was that when there's an aviation disaster, there's the FAA. And the FAA just handles everything having to do with airplane crashes, right? And there's one central authority that does that. But maritime disasters, it's a whole panoply of people. I mean, it's the Coast Guard. It's the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. It's the Maryland Department of the Environment and Transportation, et cetera. This unified command that they've set up, that seems, you know, from my, you know, looking at it as a layperson who's not directly reporting on it, it seems that it's coordinated pretty well and working pretty well. What's your take?
I mean, you know, certainly as a reporter, they've been very responsive, but it is, as you said, representatives from all of those agencies working together, you know, to each handle the part that they specialize in, but keep the message of what's happening all centralized so that everybody knows, oh, this piece was picked up here and this needs to be figured out. You know, from my perspective as a reporter, it's working.
Yeah, and Governor Moore is, you know, doing his best to keep people up to date. And so, and you are doing your best to keep us up to date. You're doing a darn good job at it.
Appreciate
as
it.
If I may say so myself. Emily Hofstetter and Scott Massioni are two members of our award-winning news team here at WYPR. We'll have more with Emily and Scott as the Midday News Wrap continues.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
And if you've just joined us, it's the Midday News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall. Emily Hofstetter and Scott Massioni of the WYPR News Team are here with me in Studio A. And Scott, you did a piece about a really significant announcement from the Archdiocese of Baltimore. They're going to close a bunch of churches, aren't they?
That's right. About two-thirds of their churches. So it's about 40 of the parishes. They have 61 in total. That'll leave 21 parishes and 26 worship sites within Baltimore County and Baltimore itself. They haven't talked much about what else will happen in other parts of the Archdiocese. As you know, the Archdiocese reaches all the way out to Garrett County and then close to Montgomery County, where it starts running into the Washington Archdiocese. So this is going to be a significant change for many people in the area. It's not a done deal yet. Next week, there's going to be a listening session for people who are in the congregations, and they can talk to the Archdiocese and bring up concerns if they'd like. However, Archbishop Laurie will be making a final decision on this in June.
In June. So if a decision is made in June, those churches close immediately or over a period of months? Do you have an idea of the timeline, how this works?
We don't have a total timeline yet. We know that it'll be happening over time, right? So it's not something that's going to be happening right away. But we do know that it will be happening over a number of years or so to close these down. And, you know, this is going to be a significant change for many of the parishioners as they need to figure out how to get to the church, the new church, or possibly how to you know, find a church that really works for them. You know, there's every parish has its own different characteristics. And, you know, one other thing that I would bring up is that this is going to possibly close very historic sites. St. Vincent de Paul, which is located in downtown, it was dedicated in 1841. That was one of the churches that is up on the chopping block right now.
And Emily Hofstetter, you've gone to some of these meetings, I guess, where they've explained to parishioners from various churches. What did you find out?
I mean, I've attended the ones in my own parish. I go to Corpus Christi. We've been
told. And that's
told,
one of the ones that they're talking about closing.
Yeah, right? And I mean,
that's in Bolton Hill up on Mount Royal Avenue.
Yeah. You know, and I can't say I'm shocked, like, you know, many other Baltimore churches. The roof is caving in, the heat's broken, it's expensive. You know, a lot of people expressed concerns, you know, to make sure that there were churches open in our historically marginalized communities on public transportation. It looks like maybe some of those concerns were taken into account. You know, I can observe as someone who's familiar with those churches, the churches slated to stay open are ones that kind of were already well-resourced. So I imagine that's something that people will bring up in those community conversations next week. You know, in my own parish, you know, we are known for being relatively, you know, LGBT accepting, if you can say that in the same sentence as the Catholic Church. You know, so a lot of those parishioners are thinking about, you know, what's going to happen in a new parish.
And I guess the idea, Scott, is that, you know, the parishes that are closing are going to be, it's assumed that people will all go to another church that'll sort of become the hub for a whole area rather than a particular localized neighborhood or community. Is that how it's going to work?
Exactly. The term they're using is consolidating. And this is something they've been working on for 2 years, this plan, but it's been whispers of it even before that. Now, you may be wondering if this has anything to do with the sexual assault cases that have been going on.
I am definitely wondering that.
Right.
Because it's costing them a lot of money.
It surely is. And as you know, they're in Chapter 11 bankruptcy right now. Now, we don't know for sure, you know, if they had seen this coming down the road and figured that they would, you know, start rethinking this. But what they're saying at this point is that it's low attendance and it's high maintenance costs, as Emily was just pointing out, that have led to this. And, you know, we've seen a change if you look at the Pew Research Center and other, you know, polling that religiosity has, you know, declined in the United States, especially when it comes to Catholicism. So, you know, there's just changes happening within the church itself. The church itself has been fairly rigid in a lot of the ways that it's tried to bring people into the church and how it's been accepting, you know, as Emily was just saying, of, you know, the LGBT community and also of women and bringing women into the clergy or other parts of staff of the church. So I think this is really a sort of reckoning in terms of how they're trying to handle and understand their own parishioners and how things have changed.
Can you give us a sense of whether or not this changes the landscape of the sexual assault lawsuits that are, you know, working their way through the courts as we speak? I mean, does this change the asset value of what the Archdiocese owns and, you know, its net worth, etc.?
Yeah, I don't think it'll change anything at this point. You know, they've already told the bankruptcy courts everything that they have, the filings. They also have, you know, these huge insurance accounts that can take care of some of these sort of issues. And then, as I've reported in the past, they also have gold rings and Tiffany lamps and tons of other sorts of assets that are worth a lot of money. Right now, it's the Archdiocese is supposedly worth about $250 million. So much of this is going to go to the hundreds of people who have been victimized in the past. But, you know, this I don't think is directly a this in terms of the consolidation. I don't think is a direct correlation at all to the issues that have been happening with the sexual abuse.
Yeah, the fact that fewer people are going to church is something that folks have known for quite a long
time.
Right.
I mean, they've had similar initiatives in the past few years. There's Beyond the Borders a handful of years ago. You know, this is finally, you know, the moment where it looks like we're going to see action.
And, for example, at Corpus Christi, which is up at Mount Royal Avenue, it's right sort of, you know,
on the light rail.
Yeah, it's on the light rail, and it's near MICA, et cetera. Where are they suggesting a particular place to go? Mm-hmm. Or does everybody in the church just say, okay, now I'm going to try such and such a place? What's the closest Catholic church? Is it the Basilica downtown?
So they're telling us that our consolidation would go to, oh my gosh, I always get these saints wrong, Saints Philip and James, right
which
at
is over on Charles Street.
Right. So they're kind of looking at it as a consolidation of like the university churches. So like MICA Church would go to GHU Church.
But are they thinking about it in terms other than geographic, Or are they thinking about it in terms of sort of, you know, general demographics? I mean, university from MICA to, you know, to JHU, or, you know, you mentioned Corpus Christi's openness to the LGBTQ community. Are they finding other churches that are similarly open? How are they calculating this? Do you have any idea?
You know, Tom, that's a question that I have myself as a parishioner that I'd like to ask in the meeting next week.
Well, when you find out, let us know.
I will.
Let us know. And Scott, when it comes to these lawsuits about the, you know, the sexual assaults and stuff, are they on hold? Where do things stand with that? We've done a couple of stories about it here on Midday, but this is obviously going to be a long process as well. Is there any movement to note in that regard?
So just a couple of weeks ago, the victims had a chance to actually speak in court to Archbishop Laurie about their experience. They had six victims. On the 2nd of May, that will happen again. They'll have another handful of victims speak about their experiences. Right now, by the end of May, all of the people who would like to come forward and try and get some sort of retribution from the church need to have their filings in, and that's something that you can still continue to do if you are a survivor. And then at that point, they will close the filings. The court will then go through what sort of financial holdings that the Catholic Church has, and then try to figure out a fair way to kind of dole out these payouts, which is a very kind of messy subject, kind of depending on the severity of someone's attack or experience and how much you may get for that. And it's a, you know, hard to put any sort of number on that. One other thing I wanted to mention is that the church has also kind of broken up these consolidations into different things. So they have things called a mosaic parish, a radiating parish, and then the Catholic Commons. And these are the three main kind of ways that they're, making them into certain topics. So one is a series of medium and larger campuses, and then the other is more for outreach and broader communication. And then finally, there's one that will have a center to provide different ministries and be a meeting place for the community. So I guess they're going to have different topics or different reasons for each of these churches or worship sites.
Yeah, and of course, the Catholic Church isn't the only church that's facing these kinds of shortages. I mean, there are Episcopal churches, Lutheran churches, Baptist churches that are also having really difficult times attracting congregants and attracting enough money to keep these buildings going. But, you know, when you're talking about closing 40 churches, that's a lot of real estate. That's a lot of buildings. That's a lot of area all around the city. I mean, that's just going to open up a whole lot of interesting possibilities. You know, what do you do with all these places? There's an Episcopal church on St. Paul Street, I believe St. Michael and All Angels, that people have plans to turn into a restaurant and a bar.
Yeah.
You know, and
we have Ministry of Brewing down in Butcher's Hill, which is a brewery. There are options out there, that's for sure.
Yeah, interesting. All right. Scott Malcioni is WIPR's health reporter. Emily Hofstetter covers all sorts of beats for our news team. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. It's good to see you both.
Thank you.
Bye.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WIPR.